The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Blogging Theology. Today, I am delighted to talk to Arya Nakisa. You are most welcome, sir.
It's an honor to be here, Paul. I really enjoy watching your content. This is a great platform, and I look forward to sharing my research.
Fantastic. Arya, if you didn't know, is a professor of Islamic studies and anthropology at Washington University in St. Louis in the USA. I've actually been there, well, St. Louis, not to the university. It's a lovely city. He obtained his PhD from Harvard University. Now, he's the author of a recent and fascinating article, which I've read, entitled Islam and the Cognitive Study of Colonialism, the Case of Religious and Educational Reform at Egypt's Al-Azhar, and published by Cambridge University Press, no less, which I will link to in the description below. And I do encourage people to actually read it. It's a fascinating study. So, Arya, would you like to introduce us to the main themes of your paper?
Okay. Well, I hope if you have the opportunity, you're able to directly read the paper yourself. But I'll try and give a simplified, straightforward version of what is in the paper. And then, of course, if anyone needs additional details, they can consult the original source, or perhaps Paul can ask me some clarificatory questions. I should also add in one other clarification. I can see from the comments that some of the audience might believe that I'm a traditional Islamic religious scholar, that I'm claiming such a status. And although I respect such scholars, I'm not one myself. Rather, I'm trained primarily as an anthropologist and historian, and I work in a Western academic setting. So that is the perspective that I will be presenting here. Okay. So my article explores a particular issue which might be described as follows. Modern Western colonialism was a system, or perhaps is a system, of power which uses specific technologies and laws and forms of education. And the question that I address in the article is, how has Western colonialism transformed the psychology of Muslim populations, in particular, Muslim views on religion and morality? And although my article focuses on Muslim populations, I think the underlying topic has broader relevance. Thus, the material in the article is relevant to the broader question of how modern forms of governance have transformed the psychology of all populations across the globe. Today, the study of psychology and psychological transformations is very much interlinked with the field of cognitive science, which is the interdisciplinary scientific study of the human mind. Cognitive science research draws on a range of fields, including biology, psychology, neuroscience, economics, cultural anthropology, and archaeology. Cognitive science is distinctive in that it posits that the human mind has a particular biological structure, and this structure gives rise to certain patterns of thought and behavior that recur across different societies in the world and throughout human history. For instance, cognitive science posits that human beings have certain biologically rooted intuitions about morality and about religion. And intuition can be thought of as a type of belief that is simply felt to be correct. So it doesn't require additional forms of evidence. And usually, in fact, many human intuitions are largely unconscious. In many ways, the notion of biologically rooted intuitions is similar to the classical Islamic idea of fitra. So
yes.
Stop for a moment and ask if there are any. Paul, please feel free to jump in.
I don't want to jump in all the time. I'm fascinated. But you mentioned the fitra thing. I'm not sure you mentioned that in any expanded way in your article, because it was a more kind of scientific, psychological. But the fitra is a Muslim concept found in the Quran, obviously in the Hadith, referring to that natural disposition, this human nature that we had orientated to God and to a moral universe and so on. And that's the first thing came to my mind when I was reading your article, fitra, I've heard this before in Islam.
Yeah, exactly. We can think of some different examples of intuitions, for instance, moral intuition. So we have an intuition that we should care for our family members, that we shouldn't lie. And if someone were to ask you, well, why do you believe that we should care for our family members or we shouldn't lie? You would respond, well, in one sense, it makes sense. It feels correct. It seems intuitively compelling. So that's really what we're talking about when we're addressing this notion of intuitions. Of course, a legitimate question that someone might have is, well, how do we know that people have particular intuitions? Anyone can make any claim about the existence of specific intuitions. What is the evidence? So there are a bunch of different types of evidence that are used in cognitive science research. One of the most important involves experiments with children. So between 5 to 10 years of age, and sometimes even earlier, children in all societies at specific ages develop very specific intuitions regarding morality and religion. And so you can ask these children about their intuitions. You can ask them questions about, well, do you believe that it's morally good or it's morally required to care for your family members? And if these children say yes, well, that's a type of evidence that that particular intuition, moral intuition, might have a biological basis. You can also look at cross-cultural surveys. So if we see that people in most cultures or all cultures believe that stealing is wrong or lying is wrong, these are evidence that perhaps people have a biological intuitions related to these subjects, moral intuitions. You can even look in some cases at animal behavior. For instance, suppose you see that animals, especially animal species that resemble human beings like chimpanzees and bonobos, engage in certain forms of behavior, like they care for their family members. That would be some evidence that perhaps there is this intuition that people should care for family members.
Can I just ask, as you permitted me very kindly to ask questions,
sure.
In terms of religious beliefs, what has psychology or anthropology found cross-culturally in terms of religious belief in children? Is it something that is indoctrinated into them they wouldn't otherwise have, or is it something that apparently emerges naturally and instinctively, perhaps, from the child at a very early age? Has there been any research done on this, and what has that shown?
Yeah, that's a great topic. In fact, it's a mixture of both. So when you go ahead and you look at cross-cultural studies, you can see that there are certain basic types of religious beliefs that are found in societies across the world. And on top of that, when you ask children particular questions like who created the universe or what happens after you die, they give specific types of questions which indicate that they're inclined towards specific religious beliefs. So research on this topic has indicated that among the most common religious beliefs are belief in some kind of spirit being, so some kind of invisible entities with minds, which mm-hmm. cause events in the world. These are understood beliefs about these spirit beings are molded by culture. So for instance, if we talk about Islamic cultures, there's the notion of jinn. So they might be a jinn.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
A new year, time for new growth. Grow your education and skills with Herzing University. Our online behavioral health programs fit your schedule and time. From an 8-month diploma program in health and human services to a 36-month bachelor's in psychology. Grow your behavioral health career with us wherever you are in your education. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Visit us online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109. Online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109.
They might be conceptualized as angels. They might be conceptualized as ghosts. They might be conceptualized as lesser gods. So there is this notion of these beings with minds that are individuals and that are affecting the world, but the form that it can take is, but how that will be shaped in different ways by in different societies. Another example is life after death. So many cultures have the notion, people appear to be inclined from childhood towards the notion that after your physical body dies, your mind or your soul, which is somehow separate from your body, persists. However, different societies have different understandings of what that persistence looks like. So when we're talking about Abrahamic religions, especially in the Islamic case, you get the notion that the immortal soul is going to persist in heaven or in hell, depending on its deeds. But if you look at Hinduism or Buddhism, you have the notion of a reincarnation in accordance with the principle of karma. So these are different notions of how the afterlife, what the afterlife looks like. From the standpoint of Islam, one of the most interesting inclinations that people have is they apparently have an inclination to believe that the world was created by kind of a supreme spirit being with a particular purpose, with a purpose, with goals, with aims. These are relevant in, for instance, the argument by design, which has historically been a argument which recurs across different cultures, Greco-Roman, Christian, Hindu, Islamic, in arguing for the existence of God. So there is, so to answer your question, in short, there is this interplay of biologically rooted psychology and cultural teaching.
So you're saying there's this generic belief, which is in its cultural manifestations, has particular details to it. So you mentioned alternative understanding with jinn or angels or whatever. But nevertheless, we're dealing with created entities who are part of the unseen or maybe sometimes seen. But I just want to clarify, how universal is this? Are these phenomena? I mean, are we finding in all kinds of societies, as far as research has told us, or just in religious societies, explicitly religious, like Muslim societies, for example?
So it depends. So in terms of the exact prevalence of beliefs, they vary in how common they are. Usually, though, for instance, if you talk about, for instance, a biologically rooted trait, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's found in every single society, because people can be inclined towards adopting a particular belief, but not adopt a belief. So to give an example, one moral intuition that people have is incest avoidance, that engaging in incest is wrong. But there are certain societies and indeed certain religions like Zoroastrianism, which have endorsed a sibling marital and sexual relations or child-parent sexual relations. It's similar when it comes to religious beliefs. So the ones that are really found everywhere is you have belief in spirit beings, belief in the afterlife, arguably, at least before the pre-modern period, these are universals. There's not one society without them. If you talk about belief in some kind of supreme God, this is very, very common in all types of pre-modern societies, although the exact rate is debated, because you have these historical databases and they might estimate something like a 30 to 60% of societies on record develop this particular belief. So humans are clearly inclined towards this. For instance, if you looked at 7th century Arabia, there is a general polytheistic trend. Mm. On the other hand, there's a minority trend associated with the Hanifs, where there's this kind of very strong focus on a supreme creator being.
And also, you mentioned the 7th century Arabia, because the Quran testifies to this, that there's a quite common view amongst the so-called polytheists that there wasn't an afterlife, that the afterlife didn't exist. When you're dead, you're dead. And that's something that Islam reminded them that was an afterlife. So that essentially that belief there had atrophied, or many of them have forgotten about it.
Yeah, so one of the interesting things is there are debates over many of these beliefs in various societies. And for instance, it's not exactly clear what is being debated. So for instance, one might debate whether the soul persists. Someone might say the soul persists, but there's no eternal judgment. There's no judgment on the basis of good or bad deeds. Another very interesting thing is that even in these pre-modern societies, there are often different currents. So for instance, within Arabian society, there is not an agreement on everything. Even in many of these hunter-gatherer societies, which are very small in character, there are these different currents and these different beliefs regarding issue. So there is the kind of diversity that you will find as well.
Interesting. Anyway, thank you for answering those questions.
Well, they're very relevant to the overall presentation that I wanted to make, and it helped me clarify a couple of issues. So thank you for those. Thank you. You asked excellent questions. I did want to comment on moral intuitions as well. So I've mentioned some of the most important religious intuitions, but in terms of moral intuitions, I alluded earlier to, for instance, moral intuition that you should care for your family, or moral intuition that you shouldn't lie. There's also some interesting evidence that people have a moral intuition that individuals are obliged to avoid disgusting substances and behaviors and maintain a state of purity. So those disgusting behaviors include things like, or disgusting substances include things like feces, vomit, blood, and the like. Disgusting behaviors include things like incest, bestiality, and promiscuity. An additional intuition that's quite interesting is this notion that you should care for your people and seek to protect its shared customs and forms of life, like you have a moral obligation to do that. Once again, intuitions of this type can be found in Islam as well as other religious traditions, although, as we noted earlier, they're culturally shaped. So, for instance, in Islam, when you're talking about how you maintain a state of purity, you're going to get specific rules regarding ablutions and bodily washing, like wudu and ghusl. So that element isn't universal or isn't common, those exact rules of, you know, how many times, the sequence in which you do the washing, but the notion that you should wash yourself of excrement and these other things is based in this common intuition. Similarly, this notion that you should care for one's people, care for your people, and protect their distinctive way of life, this is in the Islamic tradition, this is shaped into a belief that you should have loyalty to the overall Islamic nation or ummah, and you should protect the form of life in the form of the Sharia. Once again, you get that interplay between the biologically rooted psychology and then also cultural molding effects.
I'm struck, if I may, just an observation. You briefly touch on this in your paper, I think. I mean, I share the very common disgust at the very idea of eating a dog. You know, eating Alsatian, Chihuahua, Great Dane, the idea of that is just so self-evidently repugnant to me. However, I'm also very aware, of course, that there are some societies, perhaps North Korea or Korea or other parts of China, famously, where this is absolutely not the case. And dog is, killed and prepared and eaten in marketplaces in China, for example. So clearly this must be, given we're all human beings, this must be an example of cultural revulsion rather than a fitra-based or biologically-based revulsion, perhaps, because it seems that otherwise perfectly normal people have completely opposite reactions to eating certain kinds of food. So it just struck me as a very striking example. It's so self-evident to us that eating dog is wrong and disgusting, the examples you mentioned. Yet it's not the case. Some people do find it acceptable and perhaps like it a great deal and pay money to do it.
Well, that's a great point, and it points to some of the complexities involved in undertaking this type of analysis. But actually, different intuitions are structured a bit differently. So you point to the issue of food. So people have done lots of research on food disgust. And when it comes to food, people have different attitudes towards plants and meats. So it's not a coincidence that you don't find the notion of eating any kind of plant, even a plant with which you're very unfamiliar, as disgusting. But with respect to meats, you're very sensitive.
Right.
And this is tied to general theories of pathogen transmission that, for instance, eating unfamiliar types of meats that your group hasn't traditionally consumed means that you probably don't have immunity towards the vis-a-vis the pathogens contained in that meat. So for that reason, there's a bit of a different rule in terms of how the disgust principle applies to plants as opposed to meats. So you're not going to be disgusted, generally speaking, by minerals or plants. But with respect to the meats that you're going to feel comfortable with are those which you ingested in childhood and those which members of your social group ingest. So in that sense, the meat issue is more culturally shaped, but eating other types of products like plant products or certain kind of minerals like salts and whatnot, it's a little less shaped by culture.
Okay.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Thank you. Anyway, that's great.
Okay, so to continue on with this theme that, human religion and morality, intuitions shape people's beliefs on these matters, but also we have to take into account culture, and specifically culture in the form of a tradition. So cognitive science research indicates that human beings, by virtue of their biology, automatically tend to automatically and unconsciously adopt the beliefs of their social groups. And this process works in a particular manner. So one feels that one is part of a group if one shares in the very distinctive practices which mark off that group from others, including that group's distinctive forms of dress, its dietary rules, its marital customs, and so on. Sharing in a group's distinctive ritual practices is of special importance. So such ritual practices generally involve group members moving their bodies in synchrony, accompanied by music and chanting. So we see these rituals among hunter-gatherer societies when they're dancing around fire. We can also see this with respect to literate religious traditions. So Hindus chanting the Vedas while performing fire sacrifices, or Christians chanting psalms or perhaps hymns while you have kind of accompaniment by church music. And the power of ritual in particular to transform psychology has been established in many experiments. And they've shown that when human beings engage in ritual, it even is tied to the secretion of particular hormones like oxytocin, which make you feel like you're bound to other people, makes you kind of love other people. So, for instance, oxytocin is also something which is secreted when there's contact between a mother and her child, or between two people who are being sexually intimate with one another. So when you feel that you're part of a group because you share its practices, its bodily rituals, its chanting, your brain automatically begins adopting or is inclined, more inclined to adopt the beliefs which are characteristic of that group, including its religious and its moral beliefs. And this is done, you do this automatically and unconsciously without demanding evidence for those religious and moral beliefs. Alternatively, another way of describing this is in terms of faith. So it can be said that when you share the practices of a group, this creates faith in the group's religious and moral beliefs. And those religious and moral beliefs are transmitted over time as a type of tradition. So when you participate in a group's practices, what you're really acquiring is faith in their tradition. We can apply this to many different traditions, including the Islamic traditions. So yeah. Muslims are required to have a particular type of faith or iman in the Islamic tradition. And this notion of an Islamic tradition, which is passed down generation after generation, is often discussed by Muslim scholars under the heading of naql. So you might say, well, how do Muslims acquire faith in the Islamic tradition? Well, part of this story is by adopting distinctive Muslim practices, of which ritual practices are especially important. That's why they're at the core of the Islamic religion. They're part of the five pillars. The most obvious example is the five daily prayers, where Muslims move their bodies in synchrony while chanting the Quran in a melodious fashion, so with tajweed. Does this mean that all of Islam is simply based on tradition? No. Cognitive science research holds that the mind is complex and a number of different factors combine in the formation of religious and moral beliefs. So two of these factors, they're additional factors, but two of these factors are intuitions and faith in tradition. So if we ask, why do Muslims endorse specific theological doctrines like belief in heaven or particular Sharia doctrines like purity rules? The answer is complex. One of the reasons why they adopt these doctrines is that they are undergirded, reinforced by human intuitions, but also it's partially based on faith in a tradition, which they've acquired by being members of the Muslim community who are practicing a particular set of rituals. Hmm. In reality, this story is more complex than that. If anyone wants to get into a full treatment of that and how it relates to Muslim epistemology, they are advised to look at the article. So how does all this relate to Western colonialism, modern Western colonialism?
Good question.
Yeah. Between the late 19th and mid 20th centuries, European states conquered and established control over more or less all Muslim lands. So these included lands in sub-Saharan Africa, the Middle East, Central Asia, South Asia, Southeast Asia. The European states that took control of these lands were, the most important were Britain, France, the Netherlands, and Russia. And they, when they took over these lands, they ruled them in an authoritarian manner, as a kind of military dictatorship, which is interesting because all of these states, with the partial exception of Russia, were explicitly committed to a liberal ideology. So they justified their conquest of Muslim lands by claiming that this conquest was necessary for the sake of liberalizing their populations. They spoke of such liberalization in terms of civilizational progress or a civilizing mission. So we're going to bring civilizational progress to these Muslim lands. Of course, today, a different terminology is used. Today, people would speak about bringing international development to different lands. And one aspect of that international development is human rights. Today, international development is not coordinated by international European empires. It's more coordinated by the UN, like UN international development efforts. Although in terms of how the UN comes up with its policies, certain countries from the global north or particularly from the west have kind of a larger say in that process. So these European states conquered Muslim lands to liberalize them by bringing them a development, including human rights. They recognized there was going to be resistance, internal resistance to this process in Muslim lands or non-Muslim lands, in Hindu lands, in Buddhist lands, in Amerindian lands. So in order to reduce this resistance, some measure of authoritarian rule was justified. If you want a comparable example of how this process, what this process looks like, at least in the early 2000s, it was widely believed that the United States was justified in invading Iraq and Afghanistan. These countries needed to be conquered and liberalized. And this required a period of authoritarian U.S. military rule. So all of these points about colonialism are pretty well known. But what's been given less attention is the fact that colonialism did not simply involve military, cultural, and political domination. It also involved the radical psychological transformation of Muslim populations across the globe. And this transformation was tied to this transformation affected Muslim intuitions this transformation targeted Muslim intuitions and also their faith and tradition. So how did this transformation occur? First, let us look at intuitions. So research in cognitive science establishes that human beings have different ways of thinking. So if you're thinking, if you're trying to come up with beliefs, you can rely on your intuitions. You can rely on faith in a tradition. And these ways of forming beliefs are not necessarily based on, don't necessarily require additional forms of evidence. But there's a third type of thinking that is known as critical thinking or analytic thinking, which has been discussed to some extent in traditional Muslim texts under the heading of aql. So critical or analytic thinking involves doubting. More specifically, it involves doubting claims that are not backed up by kind of additional forms of evidence. So in all societies, including Muslim societies, in the past or in the present, people always come to their beliefs in complex ways. So it's always partly based on intuitions. It's always partly based on faith and tradition. It's always partly based on critical analytic thinking. At the same time, there's a balance. So, for instance, if we look at traditional Muslim societies, a key aspect of these societies is a traditional Islamic learning, and that of the type that takes place in, let's say, a madrasa or a mosque. And this type of learning strikes a certain balance. So critical analytic thinking is encouraged to some extent. Muslims may criticize or express doubts about history, about various theological or legal positions. And this is reflected in the different schools of kalam theology, like Asharites or Ahlul Hadith, or a Maturidi a theology. It's also reflected in the kind of debates that you get between the different Islamic legal schools or madhabs. Nevertheless, even though you have critical thinking fostered, cultivated to some extent, it's always restricted, so that it doesn't undermine intuitions and faith and tradition. So for instance, people aren't allowed to, in a madrasa context or in a pre-modern Muslim society, start expressing doubts about the existence of angels or the afterlife, because these things are partially based on intuitions and faith and tradition. But one of the things you get with colonial governments is that they establish a new balance in terms of human thought. These Western governments promote Western forms of schooling and they marginalize traditional Islamic forms of learning. So part of the way that they do this is they establish various Western schools and various Western universities. Alternatively, they take existing Islamic schools, either more elementary schools like kutabs, or established institutions like Al-Azhar University. And what they do is they transform them into hybrid institutions where traditional Islamic learning has a place, but really a lot of the education, arguably most of the education, functions in accordance with a Western model. And what this does is this radically alters the type of consciousness, the type of psychology that is produced by these educational institutions. So you get this amplification, this unprecedented amplification in critical analytic thought. And what this does is it starts fostering doubts about all religious traditions in terms of their theological and their moral doctrines, and ultimately creates populations which are less convinced by and less willing to follow such doctrines.
No, I just wanted to, there's so much I was going to say. I was reflecting when I had Professor Dale Martin on, a professor of the Bible at from Yale. And in his first lessons to undergraduates, he instills an important principle of historical method, in his view, which is skepticism. You doubt everything. Don't trust anyone. Don't trust anything. It's you've got to doubt it. And this kind of systematic methodological skepticism is for him, and obviously it is the case, a key facet or a key principle in the historical critical method. And when that's applied to religions, to their scriptures, to the Bible, Quran, and so on, this obviously has a very negative effect in my view. But I like what you say about, I was also reminded about Hadith criticism, and Professor Jonathan Brown, in his marvelous book on Hadith, had a privilege of speaking to him as well. He talks about an incredibly sophisticated Hadith criticism using these analytical, critical tools within the Islamic tradition when it came to sifting and testing the authenticity of Hadith, whether they're Sahih or not. But that was quite different from the Western studies of Hadith, which developed in the 18th and 19th century, which were much more skeptical overall and produced quite different outcomes when it came to assessments of historical reliability of Hadith. And this contrast between the Western approach, if you like, and the Islamic approach is not, I think you're saying, it's not black and white. It's not like the Muslim tradition is uncritical. It is to a degree, but it's within a framework of given theological framework, whereas the Western one is pretty untrammeled and it's kind of all the way through is skeptical. The one thing, of course, it doesn't doubt is its own skepticism. Sorry to be philosophical. It kind of, we must doubt everything except the fact that we must doubt everything.
Yeah, I mean, that's a wonderful point. I mean, skepticism of this type, maximum skepticism, mm-hmm. actually conflicts with our biological tendencies. So biologically, human beings have this inclination to not only adopt certain intuitive beliefs, but also respect traditions, to always see themselves as operating within the context of a tradition that has been passed on over time. It doesn't mean that you don't have some skepticism, some doubt, the idea that you could live completely outside of a tradition, or the idea that your intuitions should count for nothing in terms of your view of the world is kind of a modern trend that you get in Western universities, precisely because people are biologically resistant to such trends. That's why this is very much related to the question of colonialism. So you need to have like a military come in and forcefully go ahead and say everyone is under the threat of violence required to have their children, when they are kind of in their most impressionable ages, go to these schools. And what we're going to drill into these children is critical analytic forms of thought. We're going to transform their theology. We're going to transform their psychology, and in that way produce the type of liberal subjects that are comfortable living in a modern liberal society. So colonialism wouldn't involve violence. It wouldn't involve the need to engage in military invasions if you could just speak to someone and tell them, okay, adopt the purely rationalistic point of view. But precisely because this is a difficult thing to do, you always need this type of rationalism backed up by a military and hundreds of years of social regulation and domination. This is most evident when it comes to colonialism, but even in the West itself. The West itself is a complex entity with a complex history. So in many ways, the type of challenges that Muslims have been faced by all populations, including Western populations, Christians and Jews in the West. It just happened at maybe a bit of an earlier moment and under somewhat different circumstances.
That's very true. Absolutely right. Yeah. So you were going to talk about a bit more about the case of religious and educational reformer Egypt al-Azhar specifically, which is the, for those who don't know, well, perhaps you'll explain, it is that perhaps the most preeminent, most prestigious university, Islamic university in the world, seen by many people. And it goes back, I don't know, back to the 900s or 800s, 900s AD. It's been around for a very, very long time, much longer than Oxford or Cambridge, let alone Yale, Harvard or the Sorbonne. It's been around much earlier and continuously up to today.
Yeah, so basically, if we want to understand what happens at Al-Azhar, it's tied to kind of the beginnings of modernity in Egypt, which are often dated to the Napoleonic invasion, which happened around 1800. So Napoleon and his army come in. And then after that, the Egyptian pop, I mean, ultimately, Napoleon isn't successful in establishing a regime in Egypt, partly because the British don't want that. They don't want the French to control Egypt, which would jeopardize, which would jeopardize British control over India.
So Suez Canal, presumably, it was quite an important factor. Who controls the access to the river, the India, and so on?
Exactly. So as part of these big geopolitical events that were occurring at the time, but Egyptians recognized that, okay, if we want to defend our lands, we need to be more powerful. And the way that power works in the modern world is you need a certain levels of economic development, certain types of technologies to defend yourself. Maybe you're completely happy with the way that you're living, or you were completely happy with the way that you were living beforehand, but now possessing these technologies becomes a life or death matter. And many Egyptians living in the 19th century were looking over at other parts of the world. So they were looking over what was going on in North America. They were looking at what was happening in Australia, and they were saying, if we can't defend ourselves, we're going to be exterminated. And it was particularly hitting home for many of them because they were looking at Algeria. So Algeria was invaded in the 1830s by the French, and they were thinking, if we're not strong enough, if we don't have a strong enough economy, if we don't have adequate technologies, we're going to be looking at an Algerian situation for ourselves.
Just to pause on, so you mentioned America, North America, and you mentioned Australia. What happened, of course, there in Australia, the Aborigines, the people who lived there, suffered a massive loss of life. And in North America, the nations that lived there before the British and others arrived and during their arrival were also exterminated or experienced massive loss of life. And this was seen as a wake-up call to what might happen in Muslim countries as well. And then you mentioned the French occupation of Algeria, which is a terrible, terrible story, which only resolved, only came to an end within the living memory for some people, even today.
Yeah. So, I mean, the Algerian situation was obviously a challenging situation for Muslim populations because it can, over kind of a 100-year period, it resulted, I mean, the exact numbers, maybe 1 or 2 million deaths. I need to look at it, but it was also this notion of, it was also kind of an apartheid state of very kind of hardline secularist, liberal French rule. And this really affected how people thought about educational reform. So sometimes one might think, well, the way that Muslim populations, or for that matter, other populations, Hindu, Buddhist, Confucian, the way that populations look at educational reform is they go ahead and they start reading John Locke or Rousseau or John Stuart Mill, and they say, okay, well, you know, maybe they have some good ideas. Let's go ahead and restructure our society. I don't want to say that some people weren't compelled or didn't find certain texts that were generated in the West to be compelling at some level, but ultimately, what was motivating them primarily is they said, we have an option of being exterminated or at the very least subjected to kind of permanent colonial occupation. The only way that we're going to be able to save ourselves and future generations is to acquire a comparable amount of technology and a comparable amount of economic output. And apparently this requires new forms of knowledge, which require new forms of education. So to some extent, you have Western rulers imposing this type of education. To some extent, you have pressure from the West causing Muslims to say, maybe if we were just living alone, we wouldn't want to adopt these forms of education. But right now, it's an issue of darura. It's a life or death issue. So therefore, we need to adopt them. And the colonial rulers were thinking in these terms. So on the one hand, they wanted Muslims to adopt Western education. On the other hand, they recognized that they had created a political situation where, in a sense, there was a lot of pressure for Muslims to do so. So they said, how do we restructure the Muslim mind? Well, let's go ahead and take over the educational institution. So this really gets underway in the late 19th and the early 20th century. One key aspect of this, or one key institution of this process, is Mohammedan Anglo-Oriental College, in northern India, in Aligarh. It's Aligarh Muslim University. So this is established. Basically, what the British do is they choose a Muslim reformer. So there are lots of Muslims who say, well, we don't want to cooperate with this, but they will choose a Muslim who does agree with it. In this case, it was Syed Ahmed Khan.
Very famous. It's a name still remembered today and mentioned many times, I've noticed.
Yeah, so he's kind of the father of Muslim educational reform in Britain. And what he does is he says, okay, I will go ahead and cooperate with the British authorities to establish a hybrid Islamic Western institution that's going to train scholars and Muslim religious scholars and Muslim elites for the future. I'm going to make sure that Muslim scholars are exposed to this Western type of thinking. So that's why it's called Muhammad Anglo-Oriental. So it's Anglo in the sense that there's this Western British component. It's Oriental in the sense that there is the Islamic component as well. Mm. Now, what happens in late 19th century India is taken as a model for other parts of the Muslim world, in particular Egypt.
Right.
So right at the end of the 19th century or the first years of the 20th century, they say, well, we're going to actually reform Al-Azhar. So Azhar at this time is the most influential Islamic university in the world. They say, we also want to create a hybrid institution like what we've established in India. So the British ruler in Egypt, whose name is Lord Cromer, goes ahead and he searches out a partner, in this case, Muhammad Abduh, and they go ahead and reform. So he appoints, with the help of Lord Cromer, he's appointed to this committee that starts reforming Al-Azhar. And basically you get this constant reform of Al-Azhar. Kind of the high point of this reform is the first half of the 20th century. So it takes up until about the 1960s. That's when most of the reform is done, because Al-Azhar kicks it off. And then later on, the British have other figures that they nominate to control Al-Azhar who follow in Abduh's path, like Mustafa al-Muraghi. And then later on, the Egyptian government that is established in the wake of decolonization also has kind of a secular liberal ideology, so they continue on with this same process. But yeah, then what happens if Egypt becomes a model for all of these other countries across the Muslim world? So in Sudan, in Nigeria, in Malaysia, the British are doing similar things. And also the French and the Dutch are taking this as a model, and they're kind of operating in a similar way.
Extraordinary. So I was just fascinated you mentioned Lord Cromer, because he was a colossal figure in British imperialism in Africa, all over that continent. He not just in Egypt. Wasn't he that coined the phrase the white man's burden when it came to?
I think it was Rudyard Kipling, but certainly he had that. Certainly he has that idea. Like he very much, you're 100% correct. He very much, he's a major British theorist of imperialism, and he's also a liberal. So throughout most of history, the notion of being liberal and the notion of authoritarian rule are not contrary. It's believed that authoritarian rule is justified as long as it is needed to spread liberal values. So whether we're talking about 19th century Egypt or 18th century India, or perhaps the West, even within a Western country, if there's maybe resistance to certain forms of liberalization that would justify certain measures to kind of address other currents which are seen as non-liberal in character. So maybe if you're living in France and you have someone who's resistant in terms of giving up their hijab or giving up their adherence to specific Islamic teachings, you might have the state intervene more aggressively to go ahead and move the population in a particular direction.
Yeah, and I notice in Britain today, I don't necessarily want to get into politics in today's world, of course, but I notice in Britain today, the government or the state doesn't have to directly change Muslims' views. It doesn't have to explicitly say, well, we're going to change your religion. What they do is through education, through children's schooling, and so on, just gently introduce some very different views and different ideologies with the hope, I suppose, that you will mold young kids' minds into a way that's much more conforming to secular liberal ideology. So you don't need to be openly aggressive. You can just do it, you know, in that way through the system. Perhaps there's a more British way of doing it rather than banging people over the head. I don't know. But so do you remind me, when did the British officially leave Egypt? When did it stop being a colony?
I think it was in the 1950s. I mean, you need to check the exact date.
And I don't want to go into kind of today's world, but obviously, generally speaking, did that trajectory that had been established under British rule, did that continue after that date, or did it suddenly revert back to an older way of doing things?
Well, I mean, this isn't so much of an Egypt issue. It's something which is found in all of the Muslim countries across the world. So even in the wake of when the British or the French or the Dutch leave, they are replaced by a elite, kind of a westernized elite. They make sure to hand power to a particular elite. So part of the indigenous population, but usually it's a part of the indigenous population that is, comparatively speaking, more liberalized than the remainder of the population. And what these populations will do is they will say, okay, we're going to rule this country the same way that the British or the French or the Dutch were ruling the country. So in fact, the notion, the specific doctrine that was used by the British and the French and the Dutch to institute authoritarian rule was what was called the state of emergency. So they claimed emergency powers. They said ordinarily, they said, you know, in a perfect world, we would give the population the right of freedom of association, of freedom of speech. We wouldn't kind of give them, we'd give them some kind of privacy. We wouldn't be surveilling everyone's homes and mosques and whatnot. However, if there is an emergency, if there is a danger of a rebellion, of an indigenous rebellion, everything can be canceled. Think of it like COVID as well. So if the, whenever there's some kind of danger, whenever there's some kind of extreme danger, whether it's a military invasion, a rebellion, economic collapse, pandemic, then the government has the right to say ordinary rights no longer hold. So that's, those are called emergency powers. So throughout the colonial period, the reason why all these figures saw themselves as liberals is because liberal ideology says liberal rights, unless there's some kind of state of, there's some kind of danger which introduces the state of emergency. So the state of emergency in the Muslim world was, these people are going to rebel against us and they're going to stop the liberalization process. So in order to avert this rebellion, we need to go ahead and crack down on free speech, deny democratic rights and everything else. So what the colonial elites did in Egypt and other countries was they were complete. They said, we have the same ideology. So we're going to go ahead and put out a constitution that looks like, you know, the American Constitution or the French Constitution or whatever. Everyone is guaranteed these rights except if there's a state of emergency. And actually, there is a state of emergency, and it's a state of emergency that's going to last 50 years, as long as necessary. So in Egypt, you have a context where there's kind of an ongoing state of emergency. Same in Indonesia, same in Pakistan. This is like characteristic of these countries, is ongoing state of emergency. And that state of emergency is used to justify this ongoing, these ongoing changes within Al-Azhar. So for instance, if you were to say, well, I don't want, maybe you're a member of the population and you say, well, I want to publish an article where I criticize some of these changes at Al-Azhar. I say that it's not, maybe you say, I don't agree with them. They're not consistent with the Islamic tradition. Well, you don't have free speech to do that because you're in a state of emergency. Once again, I'm not trying to single out Egypt. It's true and literally, this is just a general feature of post-colonial politics in the Muslim world.
But now, I mean, you're just going to bring it up to date in a different way. Western countries don't usually militarily occupy Muslim. I mean, I know there are exceptions. We mentioned Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya. Okay, it's quite a long list. But apart from all that, the usual way is not simply to go in and colonize these countries and to kind of just sit there for indefinitely. It is, you mentioned development, so-called development aid. You mentioned other economic, cultural hegemony, perhaps over the world through the media, through films, through internet, YouTube, and Facebook, and so on, which seems to be ubiquitous and global now, and which is quite censorious. I mean, there are I've noticed there are some opinions. I mean, it's good that there are some things that have been censored. Of course, we don't want rampant hate speech calling for the genocide of peoples, but there are other kinds of views which I've noticed, and there's some won't mention their names, but you all know there's some quite well known Muslim apologists or people who defend Islam who have been targeted and censored by certain forms of social media for expressing Muslim views, which are just part of the Muslim tradition. So it does seem that there is now it's in a sense the same kind of hegemonic projection globally coming from the West, but perhaps no longer in explicitly colonial militaristic state ways, but through corporations, perhaps. I mentioned some of them, and soft power, so to speak, the attempt to bring progress and in liberal values and human rights and so on to everyone in the world. And but it just seems to be much more, not just universal, much more imminent in everyone's private life, because we all have, you know, even I have my iPhone, you know, so I can access all this now, and this could be anywhere on the planet virtually. So it's kind of more intimate, universal, and just ubiquitous than it was before.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that, that there are all these technologies that are playing a new role in how this power is projected. And this power was certainly not just limited to military power, whether we're talking about the past or whether we're talking about today. But the nature of power is such. So someone might think that in order to have power over a country, what you need is like an official treaty where you say, okay, I'm France and I control this treaty. In fact, that's not actually what they did during colonialism. During the colonial period, they often pretended that they weren't controlling the country. So for instance, if you're talking about the British in India, they say, no, the Mughals are ruling. Up until the Sepoy Rebellion, up until the 1850s, they will say, no, actually, we're just agents, we're just advisors of the Mughals, but the Mughals are really the ones ruling. Or similarly, if you talk about, for instance, dynasties, Moroccan dynasty, Tunisian dynasty, various sultanates in Malaysia, or chiefdoms in sub-Saharan Africa, they will say, no, the chiefs and the sultans are really the ones who are ruling. We're not ruling. But behind the scenes, in retrospect, it's recognized that they were exerting forms of power that weren't formally recognized. And that's because power is less about having a formal arrangement and more about just having an imbalance in one's ability to either inflict harms or convey benefits. So the way in which if I wanted to convince someone to do something, like mow my lawn, I could either induce them with money, say, here's $5, please mow my lawn, or mow my lawn or I will shoot you. What happens in the modern period is that due to modern technologies and forms of economic production, Western countries have enormous amounts of money, which they can use to induce compliance, and also enormous amounts of military force, which they can also use to induce compliance. And what you're talking about, whether we're talking about the colonial period or the period today, imagine that there was some kind of country that resisted liberalization. They could say, number one, if you really start resisting liberalization, we're going to invade you in the name of protecting human rights. And number two, even if we don't invade you, we're just going to make sure that you're boycotted. Not only are you going to be boycotted from Western economies, but we're going to make sure that there's a global boycott. You're not going to have food. You're not going to have medicine. So you either cooperate or there's going to be a social destruction. So those can also be very powerful forces which are utilized without actually formally ruling over a country. Mm-hmm. Although media, Facebook, YouTube, all of these other media organizations, which are arguably linked to intelligence organizations in certain countries, also, of course, play a role.
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that, because these public corporations are behind the scenes, I'm sure, connected to other agencies that are nothing to do with businesses and to do with intelligence and so on. So there is this kind of I just wanted to a slightly more kind of narrow question here about the academy in the West. I mean, what you're saying is absolutely fascinating and extremely helpful and insightful to get a more rounded geopolitical understanding of what's happening. But how common or how accepted is your analysis of its nature? Is it accepted within politics or anthropology or psychology or colonial historical studies? Is this gaining traction, or is this still a minority perspective within a wider, perhaps more pro-Western orientated
I mean, it's a complex issue. Certainly, I'm drawing on the scholarship of many, many other people. So when we're whether we're talking about colonialism, whether we're talking about cognitive science, I mean, I try and whether it's talking about kind of Islamic studies and Islamic reform, I really try and build on the work of other people. I'd like to think that there's a little bit that I bring that I make a little bit of a new contribution, kind of how I bring things together. Mm-hmm. So I would say kind of the overall view, the overall way that I've put things together is somewhat distinct. However, there's widespread in terms of just certain general points, I think there's widespread recognition. So I do think there's a widespread recognition that we live in a world which is shaped by deep imbalances in power that result in a type of neo-colonialism. In terms of how this is linked to psychological transformation and some of these other issues, this is a bit of a new thing because now we're talking about new forms of cognitive science research, which have only emerged over the past two to three decades. I do think that they'll become more influential over time, but also even in terms that the notion that, you know, that there are potential military invasions, that that things like IMF loans and boycotts are used to project power, that control over social media companies is something that comes into play. If you talk about like Elon Musk getting Twitter and how this is, people are saying this raises national security issues.
And the European Union are threatening to cause major problems. He won't allow Twitter to operate in Europe if he has a different way of doing things. So it's a very ominous and very public kind of threats made to him.
There's a deep danger involved in social media from the standpoint of proponents of the liberal project as it exists today. Because imagine people start using social media to disseminate ideas which resonate with people's intuitions, or they use these ideas to preserve pre-modern traditions. So people are being exposed to other individuals, maybe video clips of them, maybe even photos or videos of them praying and maintaining their customs and their way of life. That's going to result in the persistence of these traditions. But if we're honest about these traditions, whether we're talking about the Islamic tradition or any other tradition, a Buddhist, Hindu, a Confucian, many of these traditions are to some extent inconsistent with liberalism. So this is why the notion of using social media to perpetuate them is seen.
Oh, we've had I had a screen freeze for about 5 minutes there. I don't know if that's going to affect the recording, but could you just, you were mentioning about how, which I didn't hear what you said subsequently, you mentioned how Confucianism and Hinduism, these traditional religions were you going to go on saying how they could be, these views could be expressed in social media? And so paradoxically, you have the very media that is promoting a kind of liberal ideology, giving access to people who present narratives that are contrary to that.
I mean, you have fragments of these traditions being preserved, but ultimately the values of the pre-modern, the values that are enshrined in these pre-modern religious traditions are to some extent, to a significant extent, not just the Islamic case, really every religious tradition in the world has values which conflict with modern liberal values, which are highly scientific in nature, they really give a priority to individual freedom and critical thought over and above every other things. And in this way, they are in tension with the religious character of pre-modern traditions, with the values that are placed on family and marriage in pre-modern traditions, with the emphasis that is placed on community in pre-modern traditions. And if you are able to use social media to go ahead and propagate these pre-modern traditions, it would cause issues the development, for the civilizing agenda of today, or what we might call kind of the international development agenda today. that would result in resistance to various Western regimes and various other regimes in the world which are allied with liberal regimes. So that's why it's, I don't think, some people will laugh when people will say managing Twitter is a national security issue. I think that's very actually accurate. The notion that free speech is allowed, there's never been free speech in Western countries or Muslim countries or even in non-Muslim countries for these reasons. And if one understands the mechanisms of communication and law, one can see it. I'm not necessarily saying that's a bad thing. I'm not saying that unlimited speech is a good thing, but I would say that limitations on free speech have historically been used over the past couple of hundred years to advance a liberalizing project.
Yeah, no, that's very true. And I just come back to that. I'm not going to mention the names of people, but it's a real ongoing issue at the moment with certain prominent Muslim apologists or intellectuals who have been deplatformed or are in the process of being censored. And you end up censoring yourself. Well, I know certain Muslim scholars in Britain, for example, obviously won't mention their name, who are very respectable academics, they're imams or whatever, and they self-censor, not because they have bad views, because they have mainstream Sunni normative views and they can't express them publicly on a number of issues because they're afraid of their jobs, their universities would go for them. And I've had one incredibly prominent person who I won't mention who said to me before I even went on Blogging Theology, they said, Paul, there's some things I cannot talk about because I have a job and I would lose it. And he is a tenured professor at an incredibly prestigious university. And he self-censored. And he's saying nothing that is not mainstream normative standard teaching in Islam and indeed found in many other religions as well. It's shocking. I'm no longer shocked because I'm kind of used to it now. But this is reality. People self-censor. It's not just external pressure. It's that they do it. They have to do it to survive, to have a home, to feed their families. And that's the reality of living in the free West today for many people, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, in reality, the way that these regimes work is they create this situation where certain silences have to be observed. And to the extent that one is able to talk about a tradition, it's kind of a liberalized recreation of a tradition that never existed before. So that's whether we talk about modern forms of Islam, modern forms of Buddhism, Hinduism, Confucianism, Christianity, whatever. If one is honest, the way that these traditions are presented in the public sphere has very little relationship to their pre-modern configurations. I'm not saying that's a good thing. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. But we have to be honest that in the political environment, which characterizes modernity, simply speaking accurately about these traditions, let alone propagating them, is a issue which is restricted in various ways.
Yeah. Well, in conclusion, I also invite you to make some final comments, but I do encourage everyone to read your article entitled Islam and the Cognitive Study of Colonialism, the Case of Religious and Education Reform at Egypt's Al-Azhar, published by Cambridge University Press. I'll link it in the description below. It's a fascinating read. It's not inaccessible. I didn't find it inaccessible at all. I found it even entertaining. It was fascinating and full of interesting examples and a very distinctive take on these. You're combining psychology, anthropology, religious studies, and so on. So it was fascinating. And history, fascinating kind of cornucopia of elements there, which I do recommend. So perhaps in conclusion, Aria, was there anything you wanted to say about your article in the sense of something that for the viewers to take away from that?
Well, I hope that they find it. I hope that they find it interesting. I hope that they see its broader relevance to questions of modernity. Many of these challenges are not really unique to the Muslim community. They are prevalent. They face everyone. Basically, we are living in a world which seems to where political institutions seek to transform our consciousness or our psychology in particular ways, and but just worth reflecting on what the ultimate implications of this are, and how to face these kind of challenges, because these type of challenges arguably don't leave a lot of space for any religious traditions or any cultures, or perhaps even the human race itself, because it's tied to kind of maybe transhumanist, this kind of transhumanist tendency that emerges from liberalism itself. So they're very, these issues are somewhat provocative, but I enjoy talking about them and reflecting them, and researching them in my scholarship.
Yeah, no, that's very true. I was just reminded when you were going into off on a tangent here, when you were talking about that, the Catholic Church itself is going through internal convulsions and arguments and stresses and strains over these very, very issues. Recently to do the issues of sexuality with the German Cardinal Marx speaking out, publicly dissenting from the teaching of the Church, and the Vatican trying to hold the line in some way. And it's ripping apart, or it's having internal effects within the Church, which obviously is mainly based in Europe, in Italy, in Vatican. So, but anyway, I'm not going to go down that path, a different subject. But just to say thank you very much to Professor of Islamic Studies and Anthropology at Washington University in St. Louis, USA, and for your fascinating article. Do recommend it. It's in the link in the description below. And just thank you for your time, sir, and your expertise. It's been an amazing experience. Thank you very much.
It's been an honor, Paul.
Thank you. Till next time.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.